Welcome to the Catskill Review of Books, a weekly program interviewing authors, hosted by Ian Williams and produced by Kevin Greff in the hydro-powered studios of WJFF in Jeffersonville, New York.
Hello, this is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books. And this week, I'm talking to Tom Plate, author of Conversations with Ban Ki-moon, What the United Nations is Really Like, The View from the Top. Tom, in the course of his conversations with Ki-moon, it's always difficult to know whether to say Ban or Ki-moon. Ki-moon is the proper, his personal name, isn't it?
Yes.
One of the things about Ban, of course, is that, as we shall refer to him for convenience, is that he is a very personable character on a one-on-one, as you discovered, and even in small gatherings, but tends to be somewhat Confucian in large gatherings, and got a very bad press when he came in. Mostly almost inexplicable why he got a bad press, but one of the reasons was that he didn't have people working very hard to give him any good press, wasn't it?
Well, I totally agree with that, Ian, and he had, in my view, the worst media of any incoming Secretary General one can remember, even worse than U Thant, who was the first Asian Secretary General, of course. His media people, I thought, really were, I think, professionally lapsed in terms of not sculpting the media for the client and effect that they had. As I told him, really, in a dinner that we had shortly before he became Secretary General, I tried to explain to him that the media, particularly the Anglo-Saxon media in the East Coast and in England, was like a shark in a pool that was very small, and unless you fed that shark chunks of meat, it would come out and eat you. And he didn't believe that. He thought he could really kind of sail along on virtue, on performance, on sincerity and integrity. And when he told me that, I almost laughed hysterically and said, I guess you really don't understand the media. And the result was that he really didn't listen to that. And I don't blame him for not listening, because after all, he was the Secretary General and I was not. But that's exactly what happened. And they started taking chunks out of him. And he's just beginning to recover now. But there was a nasty piece in Foreign Policy just recently. I really think it was almost racist, the piece. So he's not quite out of it. But I have to say that the totality of that negative media, which I thought was at least ethnocentric.
Well, actually, I was working in parallel with you, because I had Korean friends in the UN who were asking me, and I was giving them the same advice as you. And I know his sort of personal Korean guard around him, and I was saying the same thing to them. And it was interesting, because at first they were a bit upset, because I sort of gave mostly positive, but put some cautions in, and they didn't like the cautions. And then one of them actually came up to me last year and said, Ian, he said, you were right, and we followed your advice. Do you think it's improved? I said, well, very flattering, thank you, send the check, you know. But And the advice was that his public performances were pretty wooden, and that he had to develop a media persona. And we actually, the UN Correspondents Association, at an event that I sort of inaugurated, actually hosted him even before. And that was where I knew that he was a much livelier figure when he was released from the constraints of official speechwriters than most people would guess.
Well, I think you've got it exactly right, Ian, and it's sad, because he brings so many positive qualities to the office. He has an extensive diplomatic career. In fact, you could make the argument that if you put his resume up against those of the other seven previous secretary generals in terms of career and everything else, he really is probably the most qualified on the basis of that data that has ever been in that position. And yet the stumble was huge. And frankly, it was excessive negativity that really helped fuel my desire to write this book. And the basis of the book was sitting down and putting you, the reader, in the room with him and listening in to him talk and think and so on. And that was really part of the motivation. It was almost, you know, Tom played in his egomania, thought he could be a McNamara's one-man band and be a one-man balancing act, but that was really what I was trying to do.
Unnamed, I actually have a walk-on role in your book in several occasions. It was I, in the hustings, who asked him, and it was a trick question, because his big booster at the time, you know, his official nominator was John Bolton. So I asked him about his view of the responsibility to protect and the International Criminal Court. And he stood up there and in front of a crowded gathering of diplomats and journalists and said that he totally supported them and would do his best to operationalize them. And I thought to myself, previous Secretary Generals, knowing that John Bolton was hovering in the area and knowing what John Bolton thought about these concepts, would have wiggled and said, I will operate in accordance with international mandates and what the governments want. But he was unequivocally said, I support them. I want to make them work. And from that moment on, I was basically sold on him, because it's not often you meet such kamikaze principles at that level of diplomacy.
Well, you know, Bonn is very complicated, we have enough time. We can go into the layers of the complication, but the bottom line is as Kissinger put it in a note to me, among the people who are informed like yourself, Bonn is really noted for being extremely candid on the need for reform of the UN, really more candid than any of his predecessors. His style of delivery, as you said early on, was Confucian. And he was constantly being pushed into caution by some of his advisors, Korean or not. And so the delivery vehicle is often has less of an impact than the substance being delivered. By the way, on Bolton, in the book, it's very interesting. I asked him about Bolton, and there's a part of, you know, the Bolton, as you know, can be an explosive character. And so I thought Bonn would be sort of totally negative about John. And he said, and in a way, what he says, and you know, it's clear from the book, there's a part of Ban Ki-moon that's sort of John Bolton, you know, on the left, maybe. In other words, there's a part of him that likes Bolton's style of laying it on the line. But of course, that is not the style of the professional diplomat.
Well, I actually quite enjoy Bolton myself. I mean, I've written, I was one of the first years and years ago to write an article, sort of quote exposing, unquote, him for being a paleoconservative ideologue, and I kept having to correct people who kept calling him a neoconservative. He wasn't. He was a paleoconservative. He was the old Goldwater school.
I see. Mm-hmm. Like William Buckley, you mean?
Yes. I mean, neoconservatives don't necessarily have a conservative social agenda, but you know, John Bolton was across the board, and not just that. I wondered, you know, when we're talking about the press there, the fact that he was nominated by the Bush administration and supported by John Bolton, I do suspect, I don't believe in the conservative conspiracy theory about the liberal mainstream media, but many of them are there, and a lot of them would have been suspicious of somebody coming from Korea with, you know, which one would assume would be instinctively conservative and anti-communist and anti-third world, and nominated by John Bolton. And I often wonder just how much of his frosty reception was due to that association.
I'm not so sure of that, Ian. You might be right. I have a different perspective, which may be wrong. It's less of a kind of an ideological thing than, frankly, I think that there's a kind of unexamined racism in the American and English media, which is to say, if you don't sound or talk like Tony Blair, you know, you can't be a leader. There's a kind of need for a narcotic fix of Western-style charisma, you know, the cowboy, the lone cowboy going in and shooting the bad guys, and that solves your problem. A lot of very superficial, simplistic thinking, and almost a psychotic need to have that kind of a Hollywood figure. There's a piece in the current foreign policy. I won't mention the name of the writer because I don't respect the writer, but I don't see any reason why you should respect me either, so it comes out even. But in foreign policy, that really, if you read it, suggests that because his, you know, because his Korean is excellent, but his English is not as good as his Korean, therefore somehow he's defective, whereas our English is excellent, perhaps, but our Korean is not very good. We don't take it that way. We take at it as somehow there's a deficiency in his ability. And in fact, of course, you know, everyone who's worked with Bonn, in fact, one of his aides who was an American, said he's whip smart, you know, and obviously you don't get to that position for nothing. But going back to the selection process, I guess my theory is a little different on that, which is that after the storm of Kofi Annan, who had his pluses and minuses, but he had a lot of minuses. And it was clear that the members of the Security Council wanted the Secretary General that was not going to cause as many problems as Kofi did. And in fact, the Chinese agreed with that, as the P2, as it were, of the P5. And so when the ASEAN candidate, it was a kind of consensus ASEAN candidate out of Thailand, when that candidacy collapsed in main part because Condi Rice, then Secretary of State, couldn't stand the man, there was a default, and the default was to avoid, and the Koreans filled the void with an astonishing collectivity of effort, and they ran an American-style campaign, as you know, which was very unusual. Usually the Secretary General would be like the Pope, the one who's running hardest would never get it. It would come at the last minute, and it would be a surprise, and you have the white smoke, the secular Pope. But the Koreans went differently in their inevitable style. They said, we're running for this thing, and we're going to be 20 lengths ahead, and if anybody's going to beat us at the end, it's going to have to be Secretariat, which they did. So they ran off. They ran the campaign. They got 21 lengths ahead, and there wasn't any Secretariat around. And in fact, what happened was Condi Rice, with the Chinese foreign minister in a secret meeting at the Waldorf, she raised the issue of Bonn as successor to Kofi, and the Chinese said, we're very comfortable with him, even though he's from South Korea and allegedly anti-communist and all of that. He's a real professional diplomat. We've had good dealings with him. We don't think he's a showboater, And if that's what you want, we don't have a problem with it, and we think it's probably a good choice. And so once words got out that Beijing and Washington agreed that Bonn would be, a good candidate and so on, then that was really basically it.
Well, it did help that the other big Asian candidate, Secretariat, was Shashi Tharoor from India, which the Chinese and the Pakistanis and lots of other people were not happy about, and the Americans weren't ecstatic about Shashi anyway.
Well, that's right. He's a great writer, actually. But the problem there, of course, is that if you believe that the UN needs reform, and by the way, what bureaucracy doesn't need reform, but in any event, if the UN bureaucracy needs reform, then to pick someone from within the bureaucracy, as Kofi Annan was, as a careerist in the bureaucracy, made no sense whatsoever. It had to be an outsider. So that's exactly right, Ian.
This is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and this week I'm talking to journalist and distinguished scholar and professor Tom Plate about his book.
That's quite all right.
What the United Nations is Really Like, The View from the Top, Conversations with Ban Ki-moon. As you said, I was the one caveat that they didn't like me bringing up, which I think he's more than remedied since then. At the time, I said, look, here he is. He's the foreign minister of South Korea. And South Korea is a small country at the bottom of a black hole. And his event horizon is Russia, China, North Korea, America, and Japan. And it's really difficult to see the rest of the world from there, particularly the Middle East, where he's tended to assume, and I noticed you needled him on this throughout, at the beginning, he had a sort of default American position that one side was always right. But I predicted, and it's one of the nicest predictions in my writing career, that the minute he actually went there and saw the situation of, for example, the Palestinians in Gaza, he would begin to modify his views because he was a person of principle. And that's precisely what happened. His first trip to Gaza, and you mentioned Kofi Annan, who was a consummate diplomat and far more of a slippery eel, even though he's a personal friend. But he banned statements on the Middle East have been much more unequivocal and strong, right up to telling Mubarak it was time to go, than any other Secretary General, haven't they?
Well, that's exactly right. If you examine the content of Bonn's statements and leadership on Libya and Egypt and Syria. If you go into the book, you'll see his conversations with Assad began 2 years ago. And at one point, Assad actually helped out on something that he wanted. He did it, and Assad did it as a favor to the SG. And then Bonn wanted to continue the dialogue because he thought maybe, it could lead to some other areas of overlap of interests, as the diplomats put it. And but he was on the Assad case and told everybody, the Americans, you know, that this is a situation that would get worse, not better. And it would, if you're going to go in, you ought to go in. We ought to do something early. I would have to say that with the American administration, for better or for worse, there has been, as you know, a very great reluctance to use military force. I can't imagine why. but from Bond's perspective, sometimes that reluctance has been counterproductive. But on the Middle East, you're absolutely right. And part of the internationalization of Bond began when he was foreign minister. The joke about being foreign minister of Korea is that when he got in a plane, he never took an overnight bag because his flights were always within the region and his vista was always within that particular difficult neighborhood of Korea, you see. But Bond changed that. He felt that since Korea, though a small nation in numbers, was like the 11th or 12th largest economy in the world, which a lot of people don't realize, that it was time for Korea to spread its wings and become a true global player. So as foreign minister, and he, as you know, holds the record, post-Korean War record for being in that position of foreign minister longer than anyone, and he started flying all over the place. And when they finally launched the campaign for his candidacy, he and his colleagues were flying all over Africa. They were going to parts of Africa that didn't know what a Korean was and never met a Korean, you know. And so he began that as foreign minister, and then, of course, it increased the trajectory went skyward when he became secretary general. The other thing about Bond is he is a person of a tremendous empathy. For someone who is, you know, as old as he is in a sense and has been through as much as he is, his capacity to feel pain, to use a cliche that Clinton used to, but is really immense. And in the book, you'll know in the first chapter, at the last minute, when we're talking, he decides to spend his weekend not in the comfort of his wife and the grandchildren, but to go to Pakistan, which half of the country seemed to be under floods. And I asked him why he did that. And I there were a number of reasons he wanted to do it, but one of them was he just feels Secretary General has to be identified with people who are in pain. As you know, as a secular pope, you see something similar going on now a little bit with the Catholic Pope, that he's saying, we know the Pope's got to get out of the regal tenement of the Vatican and get in with the people and so forth. There's a little bit of parallelism there.
On the Middle East, I mean, he is. Well, it was also in Myanmar the first time I heard that apparently he was, and it confirmed, because I think you were taking it from him, but I got it confirmed from several aides, that he was, his diplomatic secret was to be very bland and reassuring in public, but to be very forthright in person with these people. He told me what he told you, but I heard it from others that he was very outspoken when he spoke to the junta in Burma and in other places.
Well, that's his style. His style would be that in the session with the VIP, whether it's Assad or whether it's the foreign minister of Israel or whether it's, you know, the generals in what was known, used to be known as Burma, he lays them on the line, and then, but when he comes out and he sits and stands in front of the press, he's very bland and he says, you know, we have an interesting exchange of views and da 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 da. And then, so the press goes off and says, you see, he's really spineless. You know, he doesn't have any gumption. You know, he really let those guys get away with it. Whereas other secretary generals would go in and joke around with these bad guys and maybe tell a sexist joke or two, and then come out and say, well, I really gave it to him. I really told Red on the Riot Act. And the press will go off and say, you see how strong that Secretary General is. Well, in fact, it was very deceptive. That's Bond's style. He does believe there is an Asian way. He does buy into the Lee Kuan Yew view. By the way, he regards Lee Kuan Yew as a great man and all of that. And as you, the word you use, the Confucian, there is a bit of Confucianism to his approach. So you're quite right. To go back to the Middle East, though, the problem there is, from the standpoint of the Arab world, because Bond was, as you say, nominated through Bolton and through the Americans and so on and so forth, there is a simplistic view of Bond that he's too pro-American on the Middle East issue, and I think it's a little unfair to him. But I think the problem, you know, the 800-pound gorilla there is Israel, and I don't know how any Secretary General gets around that problem.
Well, by wriggling, mostly. But one of the amazing things about Ban is that he has contrived, and it's interesting to watch as an exercise in diplomacy, he has contrived to make the most, the strongest statements. You know, he told them about Gaza, he's said the settlements are illegal, unequivocally, he said they should be out of there, and yet, on a personal level, every Israeli politician that comes to, any government official that comes to New York, makes a beeline to go and visit him on the 38th floor of the United Nations.
Well, that description is correct, and from Ban's perspective, that's how the Secretary General of the United Nations ought to be. In other words, that the door is open for anybody to come in. As you know from the book, his approach to taking phone calls is he will take the phone call whenever it comes in. The UN switchboard is instructed to wake him up at 3 in the morning. He doesn't want to keep anybody waiting. He takes the call. The door is open. He wants everyone to come in. But when it comes right down to it, he feels that's the one job, and this seems so obvious, but yet sometimes the obvious is you gain from restating it, and that is he feels that the UN Secretary General position is the one job that is totally above national interest. It's the one place where you should be able to say what is best for the world, and he feels it's his job to say it, because if he doesn't say it, it won't get said. And that's why, for instance, in the first year, as he was orienting himself, he went around the world to all these sites that apparently were, you know, massive indicators of global warming, to make the point that he knew that national interest would tend to underplay that issue for all kinds of understandable economic reasons. So the counterbalance had to be the Secretary General going around and saying what is best for the world.
You did. That was one of the issues. You raised several issues about him, which I can validate and verify, which are little known to the outside. The fact that he is deeply and sincerely committed to combating climate change is the one. And the other is his dedication, which he's very proud of, to getting women promoted in the UN system. And I remember the joke from Kofi Annan's deputy at one point was that when Kofi said that half the women would be half of these senior officials would be wearing scarves, he had to check in Hans Corell, who was a bagpiper and wore a Scottish kilt.
Well, Ban, when you do a book like this, Ian, this book required Ban to sit with me for 7 formal sessions of 2 hours. So that was 14 relatively uninterrupted hours. And then we hobnobbed a little. I knew that he felt the job was so stultifying in terms of official functions. And I'm an old New Yorker. I live in Los Angeles now, but I used to be a New Yorker. So I know I took him to the Algonquin for cabaret. I took him to the Carlisle for cabaret. And we went and we saw a Broadway play. Went out to some restaurants where I knew the owner. And we got around the city a little bit. And got him and his wife in particular to get to know them a little bit, and it was really wonderful. But part of the process really of doing this book is to try and get the VIP. And as you know, there's been 3 prior books like this under the Giants of Asia series. But the idea is to try and get the historical figure to really take at least a layer or two off of the official persona. And part of that process really was for me to understand why he felt certain ways about certain issues. For example, on the issue that you raise of women and women's rights and promoting women and so forth, I have to tell you, I've been writing about Asia for about 17 years now through my columns and my books, and almost all of the Korean men of his generation, not the new, are, in my opinion, sexist in the sense that a lot of us were for a long time, which is the woman should be in the home and shouldn't have a career. We'll do the career. You know, we'll go to war and you keep, you know, you have babies and keep the home run. Ban is not like that. While he's a traditional Korean gentleman, there is a fire burning him inside of him on the issue of women. And I wanted to find out why that was. And I kept pushing on it and pushing on it. And I was showing my university class a tape of one of the interviews where I asked him, you feel guilty, don't you, about having robbed your wife of so much of your time because of your excessive ambition, you're flying off, and now you're Secretary General and so forth. And to the extent that Ban would ever break down, he almost did at that point. And there is a part of him in that regard and in his relationship with his mother, who is still alive, and in regard to his memories of the Korean War, when the status of women in Korea at that time was just bloody awful, all of those things combined to really kind of compress in him a positive ferocity, a positive ferocity about the issue of women's equality. And I think he's almost as completely sincere as any man can be on that issue.
You raised the other issue there, which is very formative, and he brings it up in personal talks quite often, is his respect for the United Nations, it probably jars with some American leftists, is based upon the Korean War. He said, you know, there we were, and the United Nations came in on our behalf and then helped us afterwards. And, you know, obviously, this was in his early childhood. He had very formative memories of the war and the United Nations role. We tend to forget.
That's exactly right. And it's exactly right, Ian. And that, just as in the book of Conversations with Lee Kuan Yew, which was the first in the series of Giants, a very formative experience for Lee Kuan Yew was when he was a teenager in Japanese-controlled Singapore. And when the Japanese would find somebody who had stolen a loaf of bread or something like that, they would hang the burglar up by his head in the middle of Singapore so everybody could see what would happen to you if you stole a loaf of bread. And after that, nobody ever stole a loaf of bread. And, you know, those who criticized Lee Kuan Yew for his hard-line authoritarian approach, you know, if you wanted to do a little amateur psychoanalyzing, you could go back to that experience. Same with Bond, you're absolutely right. During the Korean War, when he saw what happened, he knows that except for the United Nations supported by the U.S., South Korea would not exist. He probably wouldn't exist. His mother wouldn't be alive. You know, none of this, the Korean economic miracle would not have happened. So for him, the United Nations and backed by the U.S. is not a myth. It's a reality. And also, if you ask him, he feels that the reality of power at the United Nations is the Security Council and the five permanent members. And the fact of the matter is, if you don't get them on board, nothing will happen. If you can get them working together, some good can happen. And in fact, unless the Americans and the Chinese are in agreement on it, it's probably not going to happen at all. And therefore, the job of the Secretary General is to stay on very good terms with both, not just the United States, but with Beijing.
That's the reality of the job.
If you don't like the job, take another job.
Well, that is the key. It's this balance between principle and pragmatism. It's obvious you can't function without the superpowers. And I think you're a bit too harsh on the British and French, not because they're British, but because they are countries, they are amongst the few countries in the world that actually can project military power, even if it's nothing in comparison with the US. In that sense, on several occasions, they've shown that they're still sort of the bottom rank of superpowers compared with, say, Brazil or India.
I would actually, even though I'm an Anglophile and spent much of my journalistic career in London and I'm half English, but I'm more critical of the British than I am of the French. But with the British, the British is a special case. They had this huge empire, the most important country, you know, in the 19th century and half of the 20th and all of that. And they lost it all. And for them, I just think that the UN is kind of their last piece of empire.
Tom, the time has come. This has been a fun conversation, and I would recommend you all to look up Tom Plate's book, Conversations with Ban Ki-moon, What the United Nations is Really Like, The View from the Top, and to get a new view of a, to use the Bush phrase, much misunderestimated figure. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you very much, sir.
Listen in next week to the Catskill Review of Books from WJFF in Jeffersonville, New York.